Brother Glenn has served us yesterday, and we enjoyed his blessing from his hand. And he has chosen as his subject an interesting one, running on empty. Running on empty. Brother Glenn.
Thank you, Brother Dan, Brother Harry. This is not the Bruce Springsteen song, okay? So you're not going to get that. I want to bring you once again the love and greetings of Brother in Delaware Valley, and I want to say a special hello to them because they're listening this morning. As a second meeting, they Brother voted to listen to this service, so I'm very happy to have them on in the support this morning. Also, once again, want to bring love from the rest of my family that's not here. Rachel and I are here. Gretchen and Aaron are not, but they send special love to you. Gretchen is, say hello to her, too, because she's listening in this morning. And I want to use this opportunity to clear up one slide I showed yesterday in the hymn. Everyone saw George and Florence Tayback some years ago, but everybody came up to me and said, who is that little kid in the front? This was a picture, and I don't know if you can recognize, that's my son Aaron. This is about 1980 or 81, somewhere in there. So that's him when he was a little towhead. So the title Running on Empty is based on an idea and comes from the concept that, you know, no matter how much things go on, we know at some point in the future the Lord will intervene to end this world, the world, the social world that we have, the political and everything, not the world itself, but to begin the real work of setting up the kingdom arrangement. Isaiah describes it in terms of theme texts, a day of trouble, of treading down, of perplexity by the Lord God of hosts in the valley of vision, breaking down the walls and of crying to the mountains. I think that's an apt description of what we see today going on in the world. As we look back on 2012, there wasn't a lot of joy that most people had. We had opposition to Assad in Syria really bloom into a full civil war, and the death toll, it's hard to get an accurate number, but it's somewhere between 30,000, at least 30,000, perhaps as many as 40,000 dying at war. The issue is, whichever side you support, Assad, as bad as he was, you know, if the rebels win, the cry is Damascus today, Tel Aviv tomorrow. So it could be a very dangerous situation for the nation of Israel if the rebels do win. And I wonder if the Lord isn't behind that prolonged sort of event, because it could be a very significant position. Of course, Egypt, another old ally of Israel, Mohamed Morsi, became the first elected Islamist head of state in the whole Arab world. You know, they all said, oh, this is great. The Muslim Brotherhood is here to reign. But what's happened? Further violence. It's not like everybody thought it would be. But again, one of the old allies of Israel, Egypt was, you know, the stable force of the whole Arab world. We don't know where that's going to end up. So again, a great deal of uncertainty surrounding that part. Of course, Libya, another Middle East country, the National Transitional Council of Libya, they handed that power to an elected Congress there, and what happened? Of course, if you ask Hannah Migas, who is not too far from Benghazi, she'll tell you the environment there was difficult, because we know the storming of the embassy there, the killing of several people, resulted in probably the political death of at least one person, Hillary Clinton. European leaders, of course, this is a big issue. I'll come back to this later, but the crisis in the Eurozone over what's going to happen with Europe. All the summits, and there are too many to list, you know, trying to support the euro, saying, you know, we will do whatever it takes to preserve this. Important statement. We will do whatever it takes. On a more domestic front, how many of you use Apple computers? And how many of us are still stuck on the PCs? Okay. Well, Apple became the most valuable company ever in nominal terms, its market value. Microsoft from 1999 had that issue, but now Apple took that over. But you know what? Steve Jobs found out he couldn't take it with him. You know, despite all his efforts, he had the same kind of cancers that we all get, and he succumbed to them. We had American presidential election 2012 here. Many people were upset. Many people were happy. The way I'd summarize it is we spent $2 billion in campaigns, and nothing changed. Okay. Wouldn't you like to have seen that money spent somewhere else? But there was one significant change, which will happen a little later this month. For the first time ever, white men will no longer form the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives. Great demographic shift we're seeing going on in our country, reflecting the fact that within the next 10 years, if we're still here, you know, the white population will be a minority in the United States. There were a lot of other significant world events, and I just want to capture the flavor of them without spending a lot of time on them. Vladimir Putin, reelected in Russia. Everyone thought he was done. He gets reelected in Russia. Putting his stamp out there, you know, now he's put a rule in, no more adoptions by the United States of Russian kids. Enrique Nieto in Mexico, reelected. Ma Ying-jeou, reelected in Taiwan. The Serbians elected Tomislav Nikolic as their president. And, of course, everybody's favorite person, Hugo Chavez, was reelected. But, again, he finds out, I can't survive. He's being treated himself in Cuba back and forth for cancer. Some undisclosed one and now has submitted his power to his vice president in Venezuela. And perhaps my favorite political change that went on in Turkmenistan, one of the ones that came out of the old Soviet Empire, 97% of the vote. Now, is that a grand support for... I'd like to know if anybody can pronounce this name. You get a special award. Well, if you struggle with it, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. Okay? I think he got 97% of the vote because with a name like that, it's the only one that could fit on the ballot. There were other events that impacted many of us. Of course, Hurricane Sandy, at least some of us in this room, were affected by that. That picture on the right, incidentally, is a picture of our house in Pennsylvania after the storm. We spent about a week and a half clearing things out. And it was also a tropical storm along the East Coast. It still impacted many, and, you know, that area will not change for a generation in many cases. And, of course, as mentioned yesterday by someone, that the slaughter of the children in Newtown, Connecticut, terrible example of what happens when we can't handle the issues and mental issues of people that are struggling. But forgotten in this whole thing, you know, every year there's nearly 10,000 children in our country between the ages of 1 and 14 that die. These die tragically, and so it got a lot of news. But you think the Lord isn't concerned for every one of those 10,000 that die? That's the difference we see, brethren, in the Lord's work and man's work. The Lord will focus on every individual. We do what's called the greatest good for the most people. But the Lord does, it says that it be good news to all people. Forgotten in all this was the death of some of our saints. I've shown just one picture here because I think most of you remember Brother Edgar Buckley. I can unequivocally say he was the most influential brother in my life. Brother Edgar joined the Jackson class where I was in 1954. I was 7 years old at the time. Edgar was one I learned from when I was growing up. Edgar married Gretchen and I when Rachel was born. Edgar did special service to dedicate her to the Lord. Edgar was the one that went with me to the draft board when I was filing for my conscientious objector status. And I remember coming out of there after a two-hour meeting, saying, "Lenny, no problem. You've got it." He was a great brother and so confident. And I will miss him truly. He was one of the great influences. But all of you, I'm sure, had others. And we know others that were died. These were not headlines, but they were headlines with the Lord. And let us never forget that despite everything that goes on, it's the death of his saints that the Lord is counting until that time when he can eradicate these issues that are in the world today. We should never discourage the hope that the world has. We sometimes make light of it, that all the things man is trying. But, you know, there's great hope for man, and that's something that should never be discouraged. Ernest Woodward was a British historian. He said, "So great has been the endurance, so incredible the achievement, that as long as the sun keeps a set course in heaven, it would be foolish to despair of the human race." Sound like a scripture to you? It does, doesn't it? God will never forget man. Man will never lose his position on the earth. But in all his struggles, I think man will appreciate greatly when the Lord sets the proper direction for his way. Scripture in Psalm 33:18 says, "Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope for his loving kindness." Everyone hopes for the Lord's loving kindness. They don't understand today why things are going the way they are, and why do things, certain things be allowed to happen, and the encouragements we can give them along the lines of the permission of evil and along the fact that God hasn't forgotten man are great encouragements to them. We should do all we can to boost them up along that line and remind them that the promises of God are for everyone, not just a select few. Today's uncertainties can just bring despair to everyone. Let's take a quick survey around the world and look at the problems. We get focused on the things immediately in our own, in front of our own face, but forget the world has a significant number of problems that just are not being overcome. Abject poverty. 80% of humanity lives on less than $10 a day. Over 80% of the world population lives in countries that have a widening, not a closing, gap in income disparity. The poorest 40% of the world's population accounts for just 5% of the global income in the world. The richest 20% accounts for 3/4 of global income. That disparity is still there. UNICEF says 25,000 children die every day due to poverty. Here's how they summarize it. They die quietly in some of the poorest villages on earth, far removed from the scrutiny and the conscience of the world. Being meek and weak in life makes these dying multitudes even more invisible in death. Remember, brethren, they're not invisible in death. God has marked every one of them. And he will bring them back not to a world that's what they knew, but to a world where they will survive and thrive. Obesity. My daughter Rachel worked for many years as an obesity dietitian, working with people in weight loss surgery. You know, that's not the biggest problem. It is in many of our developed countries, but over 27% of all children in developing countries are estimated to be underweight or stunted in growth. South Asia and, of course, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, some of you that have been there have seen it, are the worst of the lot. Every year, there's over 1 million fatalities from malaria. Think about that. How much do we see people dying from malaria here? But 80% of those that die are children. And lack of basic elements. You know, you turn on the spigot, you go in the bathroom, and you don't think twice about it. You get irritated if the toilet won't flush or you can't get the hot water. But over 1 billion people in developing countries still have inadequate access to water. Almost 3 billion people lack basic sanitation. 2 million children die every year from diarrhea. And over 50% of those people in developing countries suffer from health problems that are caused simply by not having adequate water and sanitation. It's a forgotten part of the world, brethren, by most people, but it's not forgotten by God. And of course, today we're hearing the claims around financial Armageddon, global financial meltdown. So what should we believe? What should one believe? Statement back in 2009 from the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond said it's not going to be Armageddon, but it's going to be bad. And Midas Nation just about 2 months ago, a publication says, economic Armageddon is here. Let's talk a little bit about that because it is a big question. You know, it's a marked day today in Washington, 6:30 tonight. They're going to have a big session of Congress to see, are we going to resolve the issues that we have, and scaring everyone, and everyone doesn't know what's going to happen. Let's try to put a little bit of that in perspective, not as an economic lesson, but it is important in understanding where we are in terms of the times we expect to happen. In the foreword to the Battle of Armageddon, I know some of you are studying that now. I think that 1916 foreword is very important because the pastor cleared up some of the things that he expected certainly to happen by 1916, even 1918 at the latest. He said maybe 2 or 3 more years. We know that didn't happen, so what do? Throw everything out? No. I think we find within there was a very important statement that I want to focus on for this. And I think it's an insight that was there, perhaps not seen clearly at the time. This was a statement that comes out of the 1916 foreword. It says, the nations are thus falling into the chasm of bankruptcy, but it is with them as with a human being falling. The sensations are not so bad until the falling ceases in a demoralizing concussion. The idea that we know of that it's not something that happens instantaneously. It builds up over a long period of time. And I think that's what we've seen. I went back and I wanted to look at what was going on back in the pastor's day. So I couldn't get to 1916, but I could reconstruct a balance sheet in 1910 for government spending, a budget back in 1910. And this is the profile it looked at. And I don't want to get too detailed, but I try to help you out to understand this because I realize not everyone. I'm not a scientist, certainly, and there's many things I don't understand. And so I understand, you know, finance sometimes isn't on the top of your list in understanding. It really has no redeeming social value. But I don't like to tell people that because I spent 40 years doing that. So what can I say? But back in 1910, the population of the Earth, as you'll see there, population of the United States was about 92 million. GDP, you hear that term a lot, stands for gross domestic product. What that means, if we take all the accumulated value of all the goods and services that are provided in the United States and add that up in value, that's what gross domestic product is. So when you see GDP, that's what it means. In 1910, it was about $33 billion, a little over $33 billion. Now, you can see the things that were being spent in that budget. Remember, this is when Pastor's basing his statement about bankruptcy. The gross public debt, that bottom number you see, was about $2.6 billion at that time. And that's equated to about $28.77 per capita. It's not per household, but it's per population. And the real GDP, when we say real, it means adjusted for inflation. So you discount the value of inflation to get comparative dollars. Per capita was about $5,700. But you can see there was no spending on pensions, government pensions, very little spending on health care, a little bit on education. Defense was a big spending, remember, because they're leading up to World War I at this point. But defense spending was one of the big items, still only about 1% of GDP. And transportation, interestingly enough, at that time, transportation, railroads, and other things were still being developed. total spending was about $840 million. So you can see there was even in that year a surplus in the deficit. Surplus just means what's the difference between the revenues and the spending that's expected in a budget. When you hear them say in Washington or other places we have a surplus, it doesn't mean there's cash in the bank. It means that we're expecting to take in more than we're spending. But you know what? 9 times out of 10, it ends up that they don't take in nearly as much as they think, but they spend more than they think. So you end up not with a surplus, a deficit. But don't be misled by that term surplus sometimes. But this was the actual budget. So that's 1910. Let's look at where we are 100 years later, 2010. This is 308 million people at the time. The gross domestic product is about 14 trillion here. Real gross domestic product, 42,000. Now remember what it was, 5,000. So that's, we've become much more productive. Okay, and that's why you see sometimes unemployment, things like that, when we lay off people. It's because we've become much more productive at doing the things we're doing. That really represents only about a 2% annual growth adjusted for inflation over that 100-year period. So that means the economy in general has grown about 2%. But notice what's happened to the debt. Here we had debt of $2.6 billion, $28.77 per capita. Staggering number today. We got $13.5 trillion on the government's statements and $43,825 per capita, per person. About a 7.6% increase per year over the last 100 years when GDP has only been growing at 2%. So you can see it just doesn't equate, and that's why you see this imbalance and the debt just keeps piling up. Notice where a lot of that has gone. We have a much bigger element on pensions. We have a much bigger element of health care, which even promises to get more in the next year. Education, not a lot more. Defense, interestingly enough, back here, we were spending 1%. Now we're spending about 6%. And welfare. Welfare was not meaningful that day, about $6 million that was being spent. Look at today, $502 million, almost 4% of GDP is being spent on welfare. So you can see all these, what's referred to generally as the entitlement programs that have grown significantly. And that's where you see things going. And the interest, notice the interest on debt was only about $25 million, less than only about 0.1%. Today it's significantly more than that, the interest. And the total spending now at $3.5 trillion. So we have a deficit because revenues aren't expected to be there of about $1.3 trillion in this case. Now let's get to the title that I mentioned, Running on Empty. It actually was the title of a book written back in 2004 by Pete Peterson, who was in one of the Washington think tanks and spent a lot of time there. But he made some very interesting statements, and I want to focus on a few of those because it is significant relative to what we showed you from Volume 4. During the past 50 years, excerpt from the book, both sides have not only ignored the challenges ahead, but have exacerbated them by more or less simultaneously approving the popular things like tax cuts and spending increases. Now, the government today says the federal debt is $15 trillion. That's the number you'll hear. But that doesn't include a lot of those things that I showed you on the last sheet. It doesn't include the future payments for Social Security, some of us that get closer to there. I realize that it's going to be an issue. Social Security is generally looked at on a 75-year time horizon. It doesn't include Medicare. It doesn't include the federal employees' retirement. It doesn't include military veterans' retirement, which is going up significantly with all the wars we're fighting. And it doesn't include the future payments on medical care. If you add all those in, you don't see this number anywhere, but the government says that's $63 trillion. Let me ask you, how much is $1 trillion? I don't think anybody in this room has $1 trillion. So let's put it this way. This is a quiz that was given to Americans. And I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands on this, but take it silently. How many thousands are there in a trillion? You got choices 1 to 5. Let's start eliminating. Well, it's more than 10. It's not 1,000. It's not 100. It's not 1,000,000. It's 1,000,000,000. You can see here, if you just take 1 trillion divided by 1,000, you come up with 1,000,000,000. Only 1/5 of Americans understood what that was. It's a staggering number, and you think about 63. Let's talk about how much it is if you were just to visualize $1 trillion. If you stacked $1 trillion, I'm talking about a stack. I'm not talking about end to end. I'm talking about a stack up this way, a vertical stack. $1 million would be 4 inches high. Not too much, okay, with $1,000 bills. $1 billion, 364 feet high. $1 trillion would be 63 miles high. Oh, give or take a foot or two. Okay, don't hold me to that number exactly. And we've got what the government estimated, 63 of those stacks. Let's put it in your perspective. Anyone recognize this picture? This is the guy that always shows up in the ads, the doctor that says he's 80 years old and he has this body of a 24-year-old. Don't subscribe to his medicine. It doesn't work. To have $1 million, you'd have to save $34 each day of your life. To have $1 billion, you'd have to save $34,000 each day of your life. To have $1 trillion, you'd have to save $34 million every day of your life. Pretty challenging, isn't it? Here's those key economic numbers that we see. The U.S. federal tax revenues are about just under $2.5 trillion. The budget is $3.5 trillion. You see, right away, it doesn't work. So the new debt that has to be acquired is over $1 trillion, $1.1 trillion. The interest on just that deficit is another $258 billion. So you see, the national debt today stands at the number that you see from the government, $16.3 trillion. And you hear this thing about the debt ceiling. What that means is it's the limit that the government has put on itself for borrowing. And that's what Washington is all excited about now, because they have to resolve this debt ceiling issue. That's the fiscal cliff that you hear about. The debt ceiling is 16.4. So you can see we can't even pay the interest without going over the debt ceiling. So what's the solution? Don't borrow anything this year or raise the ceiling. And that's exactly what the discussions are that are going on today. This is kind of hard to understand sometimes, so let's put it in terms of your budget. Get rid of the 8 zeros that none of us can identify with and look at it for your household. Let's say you have an annual family income of $24,410. The money the family spent was $35,450. Uh-oh, I've got a problem already. So I've got to put some new debt on my credit card. I got to put $11,000 debt on my credit card. And the interest that's been added because of that is going to be almost another $2,400. So my outstanding credit card balance is already $163,660. And I got a maximum that the credit card company will allow me of $163,940. I've got to do something. What's my choice? I can't put new debt on the credit card. Or I got to go to the lender and say, raise my limit. I need more money. But you know, if you're the government, you can just raise your own limit. That's a pretty slick deal, isn't it? But it doesn't resolve the issue. There's an elephant in the room. What's the elephant? Those numbers I showed you are really masking what's real behind it. I told you that 75 years is the way that the government calculates Social Security, but if you're working for a private corporation, you have to use an infinite time horizon, because this is going to go on. People aren't going to everybody isn't going to die. People are going to continue collecting Social Security. If you look at an infinite time horizon on these elements, what we call unfunded liabilities, what that means is these are things that there's no pot of money for. These are obligations in the future that are not funded today. A liability is something you're going to owe. So it's $45 trillion, but the American, that's at the American Enterprise Institute. The International Monetary Fund that monitors global debt says, hey, it's more like $47 trillion. Well, $2 trillion, that's not a lot of money when you're dealing with those numbers. But the Brookings Institute, big think tank, says it's not even that. It's $60 trillion. The trustees for Social Security say, no, you're wrong. It's $72 trillion. And if you add Medicare, federal employees, benefits, you could have almost $87 trillion. That's more than, many times more than all the printed money that's in the world. So it's some real numbers. Let's go back to your budget. You see where we were when we had to add money and there's no more places we can get it. That's where you face a day of reckoning, because now you say, I got to tap my friends. I got to go to my family. And you have IOUs to your family members for what you've borrowed of about $868,000 already. Your family members are going to be really upset when you go back and say, I can't repay you. I promised this and I can't pay you. Maybe they even resort to anarchy. So you see the problem, brethren. The problem of bankruptcy in the future is a real problem. And it just means, doesn't mean necessarily that suddenly all the money's gone. It just means you can't make your obligations. And when that happens, people lose confidence and they lose faith. And today, all we've been doing is putting patches on an old garment. We've been trying, that's what they've been trying to do, not create something new. You know, these were long foreseen. It's not like it's something entirely new. Rising health care costs, birth rates falling, baby boom generation getting older, everything going, import, export, going to other countries. Despite years of warning, you just keep putting it off to the future. Back in 2010, or today in 2010, when I showed you the other numbers, you know, this federal, in what I call that entitlement section, the part that's paid out that people don't have to work for, 26% of the non-interest federal outlays. It's projected in 2021 to be over a third, up to as much as 36%. In order to close that gap, it would require massive changes in spending or tax. And you can see the issues to face, because nobody wants to take away what they've given to people. The people don't even want it taken away. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has said the longer-term fiscal deficit is also associated with a severe intergenerational balance. Well, there's some real great word speak, isn't it? What it means is that we just got a problem. We don't have enough people coming up to pay for those that are going on the upside. The way Peterson summarizes it in his book, Running on Empty, is this approaching train wreck is a clear and present danger to our kids. And it's not just here that the world faces this. There's debt crisis you've heard about all over the world, especially Greece and Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy. The sheer size of that public debt in Italy has left it vulnerable to take over. Greece is being talked about taken over from another country. Think about that. It's not a company being taken over. It's a whole country. And here's a picture of world debt just growing as a percent of what I said, gross domestic product. Because remember, that's how they fund this. You got to have the value of things being sold at least that much, and you can't tax all of it. Ireland is at over 1,300%. That's why Ireland has so many problems. England is at 500%. And you can see even the USA is up to 99% debt as a percent of gross domestic product. So you can see the situation around the world that we face, and why that statement that perhaps it is economic reasons that bring about the final blow to the world. You know, there have been a lot of global interventions around this. I talked about some of them, but 2008 since then, and maybe we even go back to after World War I, the world's developing nations have just really focused on stemming the crisis. It's not resolving it, but stemming it. Because, as we know, political leaders come and go, let the next generation worry about it. I think it's really a temporary calm. And we see we're entering a world with a really unpredictable architecture financially. You hear the trite phrase, uncharted waters, and it really describes the world that we're in today. Europe will, I think, and I don't want to make a prediction because most of those come out wrong, but even everyone is saying Europe must reunite to save itself. The likely long-term solution is not just a monetary union, but it's true fiscal and political union. Now, that could be significant. I've heard a number of you, of course, in this audience, give talks about the reunification of Europe and what a power that may be in the future. We can see it because it may be one of the only solutions. The European Stability Mechanism, which referred to as ESM, was created just last September, and it was to provide assistance to those areas, members that are going through financial difficulty. And they've already had to amend the treaty that was there and signed by all 27 member states to say we're going to render more and more power to a centralized area in order to have this ability to come out of our crisis. And the president of the European Council now has actually timed this roadmap to fiscal union. Remember that statement that was made that we'll do anything we need to support the euro. Well, at some point, options run out. Now we think, well, maybe they just keep fixing it. But I want to show you a simple statement, but yet it's a profound statement. Herbert Stein was a great economist. Now, you probably don't know him, but his son was a great comedian, but he's also a very good economist. And there was something coined called Stein's Law. And you all say, wow, that's really significant and profound when you read what he said. He said, things that can't go on forever don't. Okay. It seems obvious, but, you know, economists, what they have to do is then prove that that's true, and you go through all kinds of models to prove that. And it is a clear statement that the key point is at some point, if you just keep on addressing problems, and you see this in your own life, brethren, you try to teach your kids, you know, you can't just keep putting an issue off. You've got to tell me sooner or later what's happened. And that's what happens with all of us. If you just keep putting this off for so long, eventually, and you don't know how long that will be, you're going to have to confront the problem. If you just procrastinate or keep putting patches on the old garment, it's going to make it much more difficult, if not impossible, to fix at the end. Remember the scripture in 1 Thessalonians 5:3 that says, while they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly, like labor pains upon a woman with child, and they will not escape. So there's a great cry for peace and solutions, and the world wants it. And as we said, we should never discourage that hope. But things are creeping up that many are unaware of. And suddenly, you know, it's like that old adage about the three kinds of people in the world. Those that make things happen, those that watch things happen, and those that wonder what happened. And that's where most of the world is. They'll wonder what happened. And suddenly their confidence that they had is gone. Of course, we know this is all part of God's plan. And letting man go as far as he can under the permission of evil and show that consequences cannot be resolved without some intervention. God doesn't need to intervene to cause things to happen because he really lets them play out. And if they were played out to the full, as in this case, we'd see there will be a time when there is no solid answer without dramatic change that will result in a revolution of the people. Letting them play out would bring total devastation. I think it's at that point we see, and of course, I'm not going to be talking about Israel and all the things that might happen there, but we can see the events, as I mentioned earlier, going on that might influence that. Only Jehovah God's intervention will prevent the full consequences of destruction. How long to go? Well, we don't really know, brethren. I know some have specific times in mind. Some believe it's already passed. I'm pointing out facts. You do with them what you want. But I think the world at some point will teeter on the brink of self-destruction because there won't be a lot of answers. How that happens and specifically when is difficult to say. We don't know to what extent, as we said earlier, you know, these rises and falls can happen. We don't know to what extent the current situation we're in could be reversed and confidence restored, and we go on for another little while. All we know is within the last 30 years, there's been more crises financially than any other time period, 30-year period in history. And the best benchmark, I think, is to watch Israel and the Middle East. That's why we have it before us. I think it's a marvelous way for us to keep that picture in mind and be savvy about what's going on there, because we know that's the culminating point for this world. We don't know to what extent any of the things that we expect to happen, how long it might take, when it happens, but we know what will happen with Israel. Incidentally, this picture is a new show that's on television called Revolution, and it's about a supposed time in the future when the world collapses and suddenly everyone's back carrying guns and just trying to fight for survival. I don't know if it's going to be like that, but it's an interesting concept that, you know, at least some are thinking about that. So where does that put us, brethren? What should be our attitude around this whole thing? Obviously, we have something that, a knowledge that gives us some comfort and understanding that this is exactly to be expected. Not everybody has that. So I want to tell you a story about a canary in a cage and a man. A man had a canary, and he loved that canary. I'm staying at Sebastian and Holly's house, and they have a canary, and beautiful songs, beautiful singing, and you know it's really nice to listen to. And a man had a canary like this. And he said, boy, you know, it's such a beautiful canary. And the sound is so sweet. I think I'm going to put it outside and let everybody enjoy the sounds of that canary. So he hung the cage outside. And soon the songs were so great, the sparrows were attracted to the canary. And so they came every day and listened. And the canary loved it because now he had company. And you know, he could have other birds which he'd never seen before. And so a whole summer the man left the canary out singing with the sparrows. He said, okay, it's time to bring the canary back. The weather's getting a little colder. The canary just sat in his cage and never sang at all, just made some little squeaks like the sparrow. He'd spent all that time with the sparrows, realizing that he had the sweet song and they didn't, and he started mimicking them and going along with them, and he lost the beauty of his song. Brethren, that can happen to us. That's why we need to keep ourselves protected from the world. We have a beautiful song that we can project and share with others. And if we spend too much of our time dealing and out there in the world thinking that everything is going along just great, we can lose that song in subtle ways, just like the canary did. At first, the song was great, but by the end of the summer, he had little left but squeaks. Let's not be like that. Let's always keep our focus on that mountain and on that sweet song that we have to share. Most of the world are undisciplined, whether it's get-rich-quick schemes, lose-weight-fast diets, borrow at low rates and don't save, deferred gratification, what the heck is that? If you've never read about the marshmallow test, I'm not going to tell you what it is, but there's your assignment. Go home and look up the marshmallow test. Some of you may remember that, done by behavioral psychologists. An interesting experiment in deferred gratification. But most of the world doesn't want that. It's give it to me now. And that's where we've gotten into the problems all around the world, because we can't resolve the long-term problems because we've got to give the short-term today. And think about that for your own life, brethren. You have engaged on a life's course of deferred gratification. You are sacrificing your life in order to have a long-term benefit that will never be taken away. It's not easy. It's not easy to be that canary in the cage. But that's what we're trying to be. We're trying to lead a disciplined life. And it's got to carry over, as Mark, you heard from Mark Grillo, into all parts of our life. That discipline is important. Self-discipline is the key. It's not there in the world today. So as we enter 2013 in a couple of days, it is a time, as we heard this morning in the manna text, to review the outlook. What lies before us? In the concluding chapter of Volume 1, there's some questions that are asked. And one of those questions is, okay, now that you know all this stuff, what are you going to do with it? What does this truth mean to you? It's a question we should all ask. Just what does it mean to me? Because the statement is, once you know this, it should become the all-consuming desire of your life. Brethren, let's keep that zeal. Let's make sure it is the all-consuming desire of our life to really grasp that truth and to carry it forward and to have that hope that we can share with others. Paul says in Colossians 3:1, since then you have been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Remember that Jehovah God will allow the world to try everything. I really believe this is true. One of the reasons I think things have to go on until the point where man doesn't have a solution. Otherwise, many come back to God later and say, well, you know, if you'd just given us a little more time, we could have resolved all the issues. I don't think that's going to happen. Mankind has to be brought to their knees. And I think that's when God intervenes. 1 Timothy 4:10 says, for it is for this we labor and strive, because we have fixed our hope on the living God, who is the Savior of all men, especially of believers. It means that all men are going to be saved. That 1 Timothy, he goes on to say, all men, he would have all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. The saving comes first. It's the knowledge that comes later. That's the purpose of the millennial age. Save them, bring them up, give them knowledge, and then they can come to him. Now, especially of believers today, we have the advanced opportunity to have a relationship with God and to give our lives in the greatest cause that the world has ever known. Jehovah God will bring a permanent change, not a patch on an old garment, but he'll certainly bring a permanent change that will reflect equity and reach down to every single soul on the earth and those that have died. Not a single person will be left out. That's the beauty of God's plan. That's the difference between what we know the Bible teaches and what many say it's only for a handful. No, isn't it true that God, the great Jehovah God, has a plan that incorporates every single person who has ever lived on the face of the earth? Today's crisis that we've talked about, crises, is just one of those labor pains. And it's like said, you know, until you come crashing down at the end, like that statement we had, you know, everything seems okay and maybe problems, but you know, at some point you reach the end. It's like that fall that you take out a window. The fall isn't bad, but when you hit the bottom, that's when you have the difficulties. At some point, I think there will be a final blow that brings the world to its knees, created by itself. At some point where there's no way out, followed by a kingdom that brings blessing and security. Matthew 24:22 says, unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Brethren, you and I, the Lord is waiting for us to complete this deferred gratification course that we've set on. Let us look at 2013 as a great opportunity to show forth even better our commitment and our resolve to execute this consecration vow that we have taken. Micah 4:1-2 describes that kingdom that God will set up. It will come about in the last days that the mountain of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law, even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Many nations, you know, nations is used generally to represent the Gentile nations. Those nations will not cease to exist, but they'll be redirected now to a true kingdom, a kingdom of blessing, a kingdom of knowledge, without the aspects of political welfare that we've seen. May we all strive to continue in this way we have come and honor our Father by living the best we can to execute our consecration pledge. Brethren, my wish for you, my prayer for you in 2013 is that you will be as diligent as you hope to be in following the course that you have elected, and that I can do everything I can to help you and encourage you along that way. Amen.